Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So this week is going to be an extremely rough one because we are going to be talking about one of the most sadistic and brutal serial killers in history, period. This is one of those cases that I've been reading about for years, and to this day, it is so hard for me to comprehend just how horrific this case truly is, because the man who committed these atrocities was the very definition of a monster. Today, we are going to be talking about Robert Burdella, a.k.a. the Kansas City Butcher. And I almost said Richard because throughout this whole episode, as I was writing the script, I kept putting Richard Burdella, even though I was reading Robert, so I don't know what fuse in my brain short-circuited there, but we're going to be talking about Robert Burdella. Now, you may have actually already heard of him. Have you heard of him before, Brad?
Is he the guy that would strangle the people out in, like, fields?
No, this one, it was in, of course, Kansas City, but I think you would remember him if you did hear about him, because the things he did, when I say horrific, that is not an exaggeration. It will be seared into your brain. So, but this is a more slightly well-known case than I think that we've covered a lot here in a bit. So some of y'all may already be familiar with the case because, again, trust me, you'd remember if you heard it before, because when I tell you about the horrific things he did to these men, it'll just leave you completely shook. So let's just jump right into it. It's Saturday, April 2nd, 1988 in Kansas City, Missouri, and things were going about business as normal along Charlotte Street, a quiet and all-around pleasant neighborhood that saw many families living in peace and just going about their day as normal. Now, it was a pretty hot day, so many people had stuck to staying inside to beat the heat, and the street was eerily quiet despite the sun shining overhead. At around 10:30 a.m., a meter man from the local water department was walking along the deserted street towards a job site when he happened to pass in front of the house located at 4315 Charlotte Street, and that's when he noticed something strange happening. On the second floor of the house, he noticed the bedroom window opening, and from it, a fully nude man crawled out onto the roof. The man had a dog collar around his neck, and he seemed to be in great distress as he paused for a moment, looking at the ground before jumping straight off the roof and hitting the ground below. The nude man staggered to his feet, and upon spotting the meter man, he began to run towards him and screamed, "Call the police for me. That son of a bitch is crazy and he's trying to kill me." Now, the meter man took the nude man across the street to the house he was meant to be servicing, and he had the owners call police while they waited outside on the front steps. The nude man refused to take his eyes off the house he had just escaped from, and he begged the meter man not to leave his side until police got there. Now, once officers finally arrived a few minutes later, nothing could have prepared them for what they were about to hear, and nothing could have prepared the residents of Charlotte Street and Kansas City as a whole for the horrors that had occurred for years at the house at 4315 Charlotte Street.
Okay, I'm already invested in this story. This is an epic beginning.
It is a crazy case. It almost kind of reminds me of the Herb Baumeister case. If you guys haven't listened to that, you should go back and listen to it. It's episode 19 and 20. But it is it is such a brutal case, and I have a feeling you're going to be wincing at a few of these parts. So let's start from the beginning and figure out how we got here, and to do that, we have to look at the central figure in this case, Robert Andrew Burdella. And also, before we get into it, I do want to point out, you know, a lot of the times you do want to like focus more on the victims with these serial killers cases, because a lot of the times podcasts tend to do more on the serial killers. However, I do think there is a sad and tragic reason for that, because in my research, when trying to figure out, I was like, you know, let's figure more about the victims. You will be shocked to find that there is sparingly very little information about the actual victims, and there's whole autobiographies about the serial killers. And so there's a number of reasons for that. I'm sure one's privacy reasons for the family. I'm sure they may not want their deceased relatives, you know, dirty laundry aired out or their life aired out. And that's totally respectable. We respect that. And so this is very focused around Robert Burdella's life, just because he's the only one whose life we actually know extreme details about. And also, he is a very fascinating serial killer because just the psychology behind his whole rationale for all of this is haunting.
I'm going to go ahead and back you up on the it's really hard to find information about the victims before we move on, because just in the few cases that I've put together, like, I specifically wanted to research out and find more information about the victims. And usually the only information that you find is what they played in the case of the serial killer or the killer.
Yeah, their death.
What? Their death. You find out their death. There is very, very little to find about the people they were before they just became a victim. So it's kind of, it is a sad situation.
It is. So when there are cases where we do have a lot of information about the victim's background, we do try to focus more on that. But let's get into Robert Burdella. So Robert Andrew Burdella Jr. was born on January 31st, 1949, to Mary and Robert Burdella Sr. in the town of Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Now, Robert was the first of two sons born to the couple, and the family enjoyed a pretty comfortable life, as Robert Sr. worked as a die setter at the Ford Motor Company, and he was a very devout Roman Catholic of Italian descent.
That surprises me they only have two kids then.
Right? It is very surprising, especially in the 1950s. But this devotion was something he worked hard to instill in his children as they got older. The family attended Mass on a regular basis, with Robert and his brother attending multiple different religious education programs throughout their childhoods. And for the first half of Robert's life, it was pretty uneventful and easygoing. His family was comfortable financially. He shared in his father's devoutness with Catholicism. And by all accounts, both of his parents were very loving and nurturing to their children. Now, Robert was described as being incredibly intelligent in school, and he excelled at it, always getting good grades and being at the top of his class. However, he did begin to face some struggles from that point on. He was extremely nearsighted, and this forced him to wear very thick glasses from the age of 5 onward. And of course, this led him to getting mercilessly bullied at school in the schoolyard, because remember, kids can be shitheads. Now, although he was described as highly intelligent, he was also a loner who had few friends and preferred to spend his time alone in his room instead of outside playing with the other kids. Many who knew him always described him as being extremely quiet, and this was actually due to a speech impediment he had, which again, also led to him getting horrifically bullied for it. He also developed high blood pressure from an early age, and he was forced to take several medications to control it, and this actually led to him being, quote-unquote, very unathletic, according to his brother. Now, even with his challenges, though, and the horrific bullying, Robert didn't exude any signs of aggression or violent behavior whatsoever. The one negative thing teachers would later say about him is that he was so confident in his intellect that he could sometimes come off as being condescending, and especially towards women. Now, this unusual dislike for women would continue throughout his entire life. And that's something you see, too. A lot of the times when you do have these horrific serial killer cases, it's like, well, look at their childhood. And most of the time, a lot of them do have horrible childhoods, and people like, the rationale is, of course, they turned out to be a serial killer. Look at their childhood. And so it's always fascinating when you get a serial killer. It's like, no, he had a pretty normal, easygoing life. So that's not really an explanation there. So it's kind of that nature versus nurture thing.
And also, I can say there's a lot of people out there that have horrible, horrible childhoods, like beyond that. So I'm still on the, I don't believe that a horrible childhood makes you a serial killer. So that's my two cents on that, because there's so many people out there that should be a serial killer.
On its own, yeah, I agree. Like, I don't think just a horrible childhood on its own would make someone become a serial killer. I do think it could play a part, but of course, a lot of the times there's underlying severe mental illnesses involved with that. And part of having a horrible childhood is not getting that taken care of. And so it is one of those very nuanced issues, I think. But now, Robert also began to become disillusioned with the Catholic Church and its teachings the more he got older, something that he actually got from his father, Robert Sr., who had by this point completely immersed himself in religion, and he now actually disagreed with many of the church's practices, such as confession and forgiveness, believing that priests had no authority with God and that he only listened to God himself. Robert Sr. also began to grow abusive towards his children, but especially Robert. He saw Robert's lack of athleticism as a sign of failure and weakness, since Robert's younger brother Daniel was extremely active and into sports, and pretty much everything Robert wasn't. This led to Robert Sr. constantly comparing the two together and always berating Robert Jr. for his perceived shortcomings, and he would often beat him with a leather belt because of it. Now, Robert Jr. experienced his first true hardship in life at the age of 16 when his father would pass away suddenly from a heart attack on Christmas Day 1965 at the age of 39.
Oh, wow. That goes to show you there is something in their genes, because this is a very young man already on blood pressure medicine and his father dies in his 30s from a heart attack.
Yeah, that was very unusual when I read that, and it's not really brought up a lot more, but it's just something interesting to note. Now, of course, this devastated Robert, and he tried to throw himself back into religion to find comfort and answers. But instead, he grew even more disenchanted with the church due to their lack of answers, and eventually this led to him leaving the church altogether by the time he was 17. Now, Robert began to grow aggressive and resentful around this time, but especially when his mother announced she was marrying another man less than a year after Robert's father passed. This enraged him, and he refused to acknowledge or accept his new stepfather, and instead he became even more withdrawn, and he began to refuse to leave his room, instead spending his days at a time doing things such as painting, coin collecting, and most of all, writing to pen pals from all over the world. This included Japan, France, and Vietnam, and these pen pals would often send Robert unique photos and items to collect, which started his passion for collecting antiques. And I don't know if any of you have ever actually written a pen pal before. I used to do in high school. That is actually really fun. Now, the gift sent to him by his pen pal friends is what Robert would later say inspired him to want to open up his own antique store when he got older. Upon entering high school, Robert got a part-time job working as a line cook for a local restaurant near his home, and it was here that he would have his first homosexual encounter, although it would not be a pleasant one. One night while working late, Robert would be cornered by a fellow male employee and sexually assaulted inside the restaurant. Robert never reported this assault to anyone, as he felt shame over it, and he stated that it was quote-unquote, just one of those things you didn't go around telling people. However, it was also at this point that Robert stated he did begin to realize that he didn't have any emotional or sexual feelings towards women, but he was attracted to other men, and he began to accept the fact that he was a homosexual.
That's a really tough way to find out about that.
And it's actually similar to the Sydney Mutilator case, William McDonald, we covered in episode 51, I think. He was another guy that for the first, like, till he was like 20, he didn't really act on any like sexual feelings, or he didn't even really think about it until he was also sexually assaulted by a man in the army. And after that, that's when he started being like, well, I actually like men and all this. And so it is a horrific way to discover the fact that you're gay. And it may have had a huge impact on what he would do later.
I have a feeling this actually does have an impact on what he did later.
Because he does a lot. Now, of course, he knew the fact that he was homosexual. He had to keep that hidden from his family and what little friends he had, because again, this is the 1960s. As he continued to work, it was around this time that Robert would see a film that would change his life forever. So in 1965, he went to the movies and saw the film adaptation of the 1963 horror novel, The Collector. And I don't know if you've ever actually seen this movie before, have you?
I don't think so. I didn't know there was like a 1960s The Collector.
There is, and I actually planned for us to watch it this week before the episode. You know, life got in the way. But I do actually really want to watch it because it seems really interesting. And we're both huge horror buffs, if you guys haven't already figured that out. But the basic plot follows a disturbed man who begins to obsess over this young woman to the point he begins to stalk her and eventually kidnaps her and keeps her held captive in his basement, viewing her as little more than a beautiful specimen he can look at and admire whenever he wants.
This is not the type of film you want to speak to you.
No, and especially it's weird that this film was released in 1965 because, you know, it's pretty hard subject matter to cover, and that was right after the abolishment of the Hays Code. And so it's just really interesting to see such a film like that released in that day. And to the day he died, Robert always stated that this movie had a lasting impact on him and awoken a fantasy in him he dreamed of carrying out, keeping a beautiful man held captive in his home, a fantasy he would make a reality about 20 years later. It was after viewing The Collector and secretly embracing the fact that he was gay that Robert really began to explore and experiment with violent fantasies that he had building up inside of him. Now, extreme trigger warning for animal abuse. He boiled a duck alive, killed multiple chickens and dogs by injecting them with various cleaning chemicals to see what would happen, and even creating a life-size maze for people to walk through, which ended with a short film depicting him shooting a bunch of chickens to death, just so he could watch the reaction. So that is a huge step up from this shy kid that didn't do anything to boiling animals alive.
I'm wondering who he got to walk through this maze besides his mother and brother.
Well, he got other art students to do it because he enrolled at Kansas City Art Institute in 1967, and he was described at first as being very attentive and intelligent. But it was here that he really started to find his voice and started hanging out with the hippies. This is the 1960s counterculture, after all, spending his time protesting the establishment, smoking weed, and drinking alcohol. This eventually led to him getting arrested at 19 for possession of meth and arrested again just a month later for possession of LSD. Now, he received a 5-year suspended sentence for both, but nothing really came of it. He was kind of just let go. 2 years after joining art school, however, Robert voluntarily dropped out in 1969 after receiving harsh criticisms from the staff for using a dead dog as part of one of his art exhibits. And I feel like, you know, that they're justified in their anger and disgust towards that. Now, after dropping out of school, Robert began working as a chef at several local restaurants, eventually working his way up to head chef at some of the most prestigious restaurants in Kansas City. So he was doing pretty well for himself. Now, by the end of 1969, 20-year-old Robert has saved up enough money to purchase his own home, a home located at 4315 Charlotte Street. All of his neighbors described him as aloof and keeping to himself, but he always offered a friendly smile and a wave if they saw him, and often offered to help if he saw them struggling with groceries or lawn work. And so all of them described him as being a more reserved, but honestly a kind and eccentric man. Now, for the first decade or so of living in the Charlotte Street house, Robert maintained a pretty low profile and settled into a routine. By this point, he was now living as an openly gay man, and he would continue to grow his antique collection while working as a chef, but he also found a new passion. He began to spend his nights driving around and prowling the streets of Kansas City, looking for young hustlers and drug addicts. And throughout the 1970s, Robert picked up and had sex with, in his own words, at least 100 young men. Now, he wasn't like a normal paying customer, as oftentimes Robert would invite these men to stay with him and live in his home in an attempt to help them get back on their feet, you know, hustlers, drug addicts, runaways. Robert would befriend the young men he saw as having fallen on hard times, and he would offer to help them get back on the right track. He would offer to allow them to live with him and give them money in exchange for sexual favors. He would later state that he was growing increasingly frustrated with the boys he tried to help because a lot of them seemed to be uninterested in his help and wanted to keep doing what they were doing. So honestly, for a time, he actually was legitimately trying to do good, I guess. Like, he was helping these young men, like, get into programs, to get into rehab, and like he did genuinely seem to want to be a nice man
I
at
think there
first.
was a lot of ulterior motives involved in that as well.
There definitely was. He wanted the sexual favors and stuff. We'll touch on it a little later, but like in his twisted mind, he was like, but also like, I want to have sex with them, but I'm going to be a hero to them. I'm going to be the one that gets them clean.
This is also keeping them his like hostage in the lot way, like make them dependent on me and show them how good I am. And basically, you know, make them super dependent on me so that they can't leave. So technically, they're still my captive. This is just the Lot version of it, I think.
And that's actually a really good way to work at it, because he didn't just go from 0 to 100, like just thinking about it and then keeping people captive. It was a gradual process. And you are right in the fact that I think this was the starting stages of that fantasy. Like, he made them indebted to him, and so they felt like they had to stick around and live with him. And so it was voluntary, but it was still pretty captive because he hung things over their heads. But also, in fact, during this time, he was actually extremely active in the Neighborhood Crime Prevention Association, and at one point was even their chairman. To everyone, he seemed to be a man who was genuinely concerned with helping people, and for a time, like I said, he seemed to be. However, deep inside, a darkness was growing in Robert that even he would say surprised him. The fantasy of keeping a beautiful young man captive kept popping up in his mind despite trying to ignore it. On top of that, he kept having frequent violent fantasies whenever he was with a hustler. Around this time, Robert was also heavily involved with alcohol and drugs, and he had become overweight, and he started to feel a growing resentment towards the skinny and pretty sex workers he saw walking the streets at night. So that's another thing, too. The pot's calling the kettle black. He has an alcohol and drug problem himself, but at the same time, he's trying to be like, to these, you know, hustlers, like, I'm going to help you get off of it, but I'm going to keep doing what I'm going to do. Now, on top of his work with crime prevention, Robert finally followed through with his dream of opening up an antique store, and in 1982, he rented a booth at a local flea market and opened up his store called Bob's Bazaar Bazaar, which he would sell the various art pieces and items he had collected over the years. And the business was a moderate success, and it helped him meet more people, since at this point, Robert's only friends were the hustlers he paid to spend time with him. Now, one of those friends was a man named Paul Howell, who owned a booth at the market beside Robert's. Now, Paul had a young son, 17-year-old Jerry Howell, who would often spend time at his father's booth. Jerry seemed to be fascinated by Robert, and in particular, how open Robert was about his homosexuality. In front of his father, he acted like it disgusted him, but when they were alone, Robert and Jerry would often talk about it, with Jerry confiding in Robert that he sometimes slept with men in order to make extra money. Now, Robert and Jerry would often talk about it with Jerry confiding in Robert that he sometimes slept with men in order to make extra money. Over the next few years, Paul moved his store to another location, and he lost touch with Robert, but Jerry continued to have a casual relationship with him. Robert acted as someone Jerry could confide in or come to if he ever got into trouble, and at times he did. At one point in 1984, Jerry was arrested for prostitution, and he called Robert to bail him out so his dad didn't find out. Robert did so, and Jerry promised he would pay him back the bail money as soon as he could. But little did Jerry know that Robert's sadistic fantasies were getting stronger, and he would be Robert's first victim. So on July 5th, 1984, Robert had actually agreed to drive Jerry to a dance contest located in Merriam, Kansas. So he picked Jerry up, and they drove back to Robert's house for a bit in order to drink and smoke weed before they hit the road. By this point, Robert would later state that he was already frustrated with Jerry, since he felt like Jerry was always taking advantage of him and never paid him back for bailing him out of jail. But now, what finally made Robert give in to his twisted fantasies will never be known, as Robert never gave a reason as to why he finally decided to act upon them. As the two got drunk and high, Robert attempted to have sex with Jerry, but Jerry refused, which angered Robert. Now, Robert felt he was at least owed sex for everything he had done for Jerry, and decided that if he wouldn't do it willingly, Robert was just going to drug Jerry and take it by force. Now, Robert continued to ply Jerry with copious amounts of alcohol, cocaine, and several other drugs until the teenager passed out asleep on the couch. Once he was asleep, Robert went and got a syringe, which he filled with a tranquilizer, which, where he got a tranquilizer from, who the hell knows?
It was a simpler time back then.
Again, it was the 80s. I guess it was a lot less regulated back then. But after injecting Jerry with the drugs, Robert stripped him naked and proceeded to tie his hands behind his back. Now, for the whole next part of this, extreme trigger warning, because what follows next is very disturbing and it involves frequent sexual assault. Now, with his victims completely helpless and unable to fight back, Robert finally gave into all his violent fantasies. He sexually assaulted Jerry at least 5 times and only stopped because, in his own words, he couldn't ejaculate anymore. He carried Jerry upstairs and tied him to the bed and continued the assaults there. He used a cucumber to anally assault him before switching to a carrot. And Robert would take Polaroids of all of this and keep a detailed journal in which he documented all the ways he tortured his victim. By the end of the assaults, Robert stated Jerry's anus was bleeding profusely. Robert continued to inject Jerry with drugs to keep him subdued, and over the next 28 hours, kept him prisoner as he continued to sexually assault him over and over. The next day, Robert went to work as normal before returning home to continue the torture. Now, after assaulting Jerry 3 more times, Robert was filled with an uncontrollable rage and proceeded to beat Jerry over the back with a metal pipe. At several points during his torture, Jerry actually woke up from his drug coma and begged Robert to let him go, but all of his pleas were ignored or he was laughed at by Robert. Finally, at 10 p.m. on July 5th, Jerry Howe would pass away after the combination of drugs he was given caused him to choke to death on his own vomit. We know his exact time of death because Robert documented it in his journal. Following his death, Robert was faced with a new problem. How was he going to get rid of Jerry's body? Now, Robert would later tell police that he tried to resuscitate Jerry at first, but after realizing he was dead, he dragged his body into the basement of his home. He used ropes to suspend Jerry's body upside down over a large cooking pot and then made incisions to Jerry's jugular vein and in his inner elbows to allow all the blood to drain from his body. The next day after the blood was drained, Robert went about dismembering Jerry's corpse. He tried to use a handsaw but found that it was too dull to cut through the bone, and so instead, he decided to dismember Jerry with a chainsaw. After dismembering Jerry into small enough pieces, Robert wrapped all the pieces in newspaper before stuffing them inside of several large garbage bags, along with any other evidence that Jerry had been there. After he was done doing that, he waited till Monday and then just casually set all the trash bags out on the curb to be picked up by the trash collectors. He watched as the workers loaded his garbage into the back of their truck to take to a landfill, completely unaware that they contained the dismembered remains of a 19-year-old boy. Following Jerry's murder, Robert was actually very briefly questioned in connection with Jerry's disappearance. However, he told investigators that he dropped Jerry off in Merriam and that was the last he saw of him. And this was good enough for investigators since Jerry had run away before, and thus his case was kind of just closed for the time being, and Robert had just gotten away with his first murder. And now that is another fascinating thing. He gets rid of all of his victims this way. He literally just wraps them in trash bags and sets them at the curb for Monday trash pickup. And just, it's so weird to think, like, this is the one, like, serial killer that, like, had unknowing accomplices, like, discard the body for him. Now, for the next 10 months, Robert maintained a low profile. He didn't want to press his luck and do something that could land him in prison or cause police to become suspicious of him. Instead, he chose to fantasize over the Polaroids he had taken of Jerry during his captivity. He would look at the photos each day and masturbate over them several times. Robert would later tell investigators that for the first few months after the murder, he was actually racked with guilt over what he had done, and he promised himself that he would never lose control like that again, and that he was going to continue fighting his dark urges. However, after it became clear that police weren't even looking for Jerry, since Robert's own words, nobody cared about a missing gay street prostitute, which is sad and extremely true.
Especially back then.
Yeah, especially back in the 1980s.
But it probably hasn't changed much today.
No, sex workers in general, both gay, straight, no matter what, are very much treated as
throwaway trash.
Throwaway cases, like
not a human being like they actually are.
Exactly. For almost a year, Robert committed no crimes, and that is until April 10th, 1985, when an opportunity quite literally showed up on his doorstep. So I mentioned before that throughout the 1970s, after he first moved into his home, Robert started spending quite a lot of time with the local gay street hustlers around Kansas City. He didn't just pay for their company, but he also allowed them to live with him, offered them money to get back on their feet, and really created actual relationships with a lot of these young men. He gained a reputation amongst the hustlers for his generosity, and that meant a lot of the times, new hustlers would actually seek Robert out for help. And that's exactly what 20-year-old Robert Sheldon did on April 10th. And also to avoid confusion, I'm going to refer to Robert Sheldon by his last name from here on out. So Sheldon was a homeless drifter who had spent time with Robert in the past and was now looking to get his life back on track. That day, he asked Robert if he could rent a room at his house for a few weeks while he got back on his feet, and Robert agreed to lodge him. But from the moment Sheldon stepped foot in the house, Robert began fantasizing about what he could do to torture him. Robert later admitted that he wasn't attracted to Sheldon at all, but that didn't stop him from contemplating keeping Sheldon captive as a sex slave, like in the movie The Collector. He felt the opportunity was just too good to pass up. Robert, though, felt no desire to sexually assault Robert like he did with Jerry or Sheldon. However, he felt that Sheldon may be the perfect candidate to try out his other quote-unquote experiments and tortures on. So unlike Jerry, he was like, I have no interest in actually assaulting Sheldon, but he would be a nice guinea pig to try out these new torture fantasies I have in my head.
I'm not attracted to you, but I'm going to torture you to death.
Exactly. He saw him as a lab experiment. Now, Robert stated that although Sheldon paid his rent on time and without hassle, there was something about him that angered Robert, and he considered him to be an inconvenience. For several days, he flip-flopped back and forth on whether or not he wanted to sexually assault Sheldon, and on at least four separate occasions when the two were getting drunk and high together, Robert injected him with the sedatives and tied him up. However, each time, he felt the desire to assault Sheldon leave his body, and he would just untie him and let him sleep off the drug effects. At one point after being drugged, Sheldon actually complained about feeling sore and sick, and Robert actually took him to the ER to get treated. But finally, on April 12th, Robert's violent side was too much to control, and he drugged Sheldon after coming home to find him passed out drunk. After knocking him out, Robert carried Sheldon to an upstairs bedroom located on the second floor of the house, tied his hands and feet to the bed, and Robert began to grow excited at the idea of keeping Sheldon captive and experimenting on him. He wanted to keep Sheldon alive as long as possible and use him to test out what torture methods he liked so as to use them on others he found attractive. Robert spent the next 3 hours sexually assaulting Sheldon, assaulting him at least four times before assaulting him with both a cucumber and a carrot. Now, again, trigger warning, this is where the extreme stuff starts to happen. Robert then got the idea that if he could somehow blind his captive, it would make him more docile and easier to control. So once Sheldon had awoken from the drugs, Robert proceeded to get a bottle of liquid drain cleaner and pour it directly into Sheldon's eyes before using a cotton swab to really rub it in there. He also filled a syringe with drain cleaner and injected it directly into Sheldon's ear in an attempt to make him deaf. All this caused Sheldon to scream in agony, which only excited Robert more. Robert went downstairs and grabbed a hammer, which he then used to smash the bones in Sheldon's hands and knees while he masturbated over top of him. Eventually, Robert knew that Sheldon's screams could potentially be heard by the neighbors, and so he drugged him into unconsciousness again. For the next 3 days, Sheldon was held captive, assaulted, and horrifically tortured by Robert. He had caulking poured into his ears to make it harder for him to hear. He had his hands and feet tied tightly together with piano wire, with the intention being to permanently damage the nerves in his wrists and hands. He was beaten with a metal pipe and sexually assaulted at least 3 times a day with various objects. Robert heated up a metal coat hanger until it was red hot and proceeded to brand Sheldon with the word hot across his shoulders. Robert began to stick needles all over Sheldon's body to see how he'd react, but mainly stuck the needles in his testicles and under his fingernails. Throughout all this, Robert took hundreds of Polaroid pictures of the torture in order to masturbate to it later, and it was here he realized how much sexual gratification he truly got from inflicting as much pain as possible caused to his victims. Robert grew excited the more he thought about the different ways he wanted to try and torture Sheldon. He went out and bought a 7,000-volt electrical transformer with the intention to see how his captive would react to being electrocuted. Robert hooked alligator clamps to Sheldon's nipples and turned on the machine. Robert would stand over Sheldon and masturbate as his body convulsed and twisted on the bed. Eventually, Robert began to jam needles into various parts of Sheldon's body and hooked the clamps to them to make Sheldon convulse even more. Robert electrocuted Sheldon multiple times a day, sometimes for upwards of 5 minutes, and he documented all of it with his Polaroid camera. He also wrote down extensive notes about the torture in his journal. He talked about his captive's reaction and listed the different torture methods in order of how much they excited him. He talked about how the piano wire he tied around Sheldon's wrist began to eat through his flesh and cut parts of his tendons and nerves, and the look on his face whenever he was being electrocuted. Sheldon suffered for 3 days before finally, on April 15th, his torment would come to an end.
This is absolutely horrible. It's really hard to listen to, honestly. Just all the stuff that happened to this poor man.
And it only gets worse, because from this point on, Robert only amps up the torture to his victims.
I do want to add, too, I think the word electrocuted means to be killed by electricity, and the word that you're looking for is shocked.
Shocked, yeah. So he was looking to shock him, because as we'll find out, Robert did not want to kill his victims. That would defeat the purpose of what he was doing it for in the first place.
That's your little tidbit message for the day. You learned that electrocution means to die by electricity, and the other is shocked.
There you go. The more you know. So on April 15th, that day, Robert returned home from work to find a handyman outside his home trimming trees. He forgot he had hired the man months earlier and panicked about the man potentially seeing or hearing Sheldon up on the second floor. Robert rushed inside the house and upstairs, where he proceeded to wrap a plastic bag around Sheldon's head and suffocate him to death. Robert would later recall how heartbroken he was that Sheldon had to die so soon and so fast, but with that, Robert claimed his second victim. After the handyman left, Robert dragged Sheldon's body into the bathtub on the third floor of the home, slashed his throat open to allow the body to drain of blood, and after that, he dismembered Sheldon's body with a bone saw and a chainsaw in order to decapitate the body. He wrapped each severed piece in newspaper and placed it inside of trash bags, but this time he wanted to keep a trophy, because last time he got rid of all evidence Jerry was there, but he wanted to keep a memento this time. And so he decided to keep Sheldon's severed head, which he buried in his backyard before disposing of the rest of his remains elsewhere. Unlike with Jerry, Robert felt no remorse for killing Sheldon, and instead, he was excited and eager to go out and find a new victim. This time, though, one he was sexually attracted to, and he could try out his new torture method on them. So, Robert was ready to strike again. He no longer felt the need to try and fight the urges or wait almost a year between kills. There was no police investigation into Robert Sheldon's sudden disappearance, and as far as Robert could tell, nobody even realized that the young man was missing. He had gotten away with 2 murders, and no one was none the wiser. And again, that's another sad reality you see a lot of the times. A lot of times, you know, hustlers, you know, serial killers do target the more vulnerable in society, homeless, drug addicts, hustlers, people that are sadly not often missed by a lot of people or notice that they're missing. And so it is very sad. So Robert would often stand in his backyard, staring at the spot where he buried Sheldon's severed head, and he would fantasize about the torture and the killing of the young man, which often led to him masturbating over the yard where the severed head was buried. Over the next few months, as summer and the heat crept into Kansas City, Robert began to hire some of the local street hustlers to come over to his house in order to do some yard work. One of those hustlers he hired was 27-year-old homeless drifter Mark Wallace. Now, Mark was like many of the other hustlers Robert knew. He was down on his luck, staying wherever he could to keep warm, and he was desperate for money. At first, Robert didn't pay him for sex, but simply hired him to do some gardening work around the yard. Robert would often watch Mark as he mowed the yard and pulled the weeds, and any time Mark would get close to or even sometimes stand over the spot where Sheldon's head was buried, Robert would get so excited that he'd have to go and masturbate. He spent many months fantasizing about sexually assaulting Mark and all the different torture methods he would love to try on him, but he never felt the time was right to strike. That is until June 22, 1985, when again, the opportunity presented itself right in his backyard. That day, a severe thunderstorm hit Kansas City, and after noticing his dogs barking in the backyard, Robert went outside to discover Mark taking shelter inside of his garden shed. He was cold and hungry, and Robert offered to let him come inside to get out of the storm. Once inside, Robert began to supply Mark with beer, and Mark really began to open up to Robert about his struggles with depression and his eagerness to get his life back on track. Sensing that Mark was anxious and depressed, Robert offered to give him a calming tranquilizer that would help ease his nerves. Mark agreed, and Robert injected him with 2 cc's of chlorpromazine, I hope I pronounced that right, a sedative that put Mark to sleep. After that, Robert injected him with ketamine, and that rendered him completely unconscious. Robert stripped him naked and tied his hands and feet behind his back before sexually assaulting him with a carrot and masturbating over top of him. He carried Mark upstairs and tied him to the same bed he had Sheldon, and again sexually assaulted him at least 3 times. Robert didn't give Mark as many sedatives as he had with Jerry and Sheldon, as this time he wanted Mark to be aware of what was happening so he'd be quote-unquote more into it. He beat Mark over the head with a rubber mallet anytime his screams became too much, and he even used it to smash his testicles. Robert spent 5 hours attaching alligator clamps to Mark, alternating between clamping them on his nipples and testicles, and watching for minutes at a time as Mark convulsed and tried to scream through the shocks. Between each session, Robert wrote meticulous notes in his journals about the torture and Mark's reaction to it. For the next day, Robert spent his time assaulting and shocking Mark in and out of consciousness. The day after, Robert went to work without drugging Mark, thinking he'd be docile enough at this point after his hours of torture to be left alone. Robert returned home at about 4 p.m. to find Mark attempting to escape. Enraged, Robert injected Mark with ketamine until he was knocked out. He then got a large syringe and proceeded to inject dish soap and laundry detergent into Mark's rectum, hoping that it would, quote-unquote, clean out all of the blood and, in his own words, lubricated enough so that I could fit my whole fist inside of his anus. Robert spent the night of June 23rd sticking needles into various parts of Mark's body and moving them around inside of him to see his reaction. He enjoyed watching as Mark screamed whenever one of the needles would hit a nerve in his arm or back. He even stuck several needles into Mark's eyes to see what would happen. Whenever he found a spot on the body that elicited the most pain and reaction from Mark, he would make a note of it in his journal so he wouldn't forget it and could use it on future victims. On top of all of this, Robert continued to sodomize Mark over and over, using various objects around the house to do it as well. As his torture escalated, Robert injected Mark with more and more drugs to keep him docile, and he eventually lost track of how much of what he injected Mark with. Eventually, Robert realized that Mark was no longer reacting to his torture, and after checking his pulse, realized that he had died. He wrote down in his journal, 7 a.m., no signs of life. Robert believes the cause of death was due to a combination of the drugs, the gag, and the inability to breathe properly. After his death, Robert again dragged the body to the upstairs bathroom and drained it of blood before dismembering the corpse with a bone saw and a chainsaw. He wrapped Mark's severed limbs in newspaper before stuffing them in dog food bags and then in trash bags, rolling them out to the curb in the morning for the garbage man to pick up and take to the landfill. Again, his plan went off without a hitch, and the body was picked up and disposed of in a landfill, and he didn't have to do anything, and no one was none the wiser. Nobody came looking for Mark or asking questions, and again, nobody seemed to even know he was gone missing. Robert had gone away with a third murder and was now officially a serial killer. Following Mark's murder, Robert was feeling disappointed in himself. Mark had died less than 48 hours after he was taken captive. It was over too quickly for Robert's liking, and he started to realize that if he truly wanted to fulfill his fantasy of having a captive slave, he was going to need to learn to control his torture and to pace himself in order to keep his victim alive as long as possible. Robert even admitted it was never his intention to kill any of his victims. If they died, that meant he could no longer hear their screams or torture them. His goal was always to keep them alive as long as possible and to prolong their suffering as much as he could. So that's what I'm saying, the difference, like, what makes him such a fascinating and unique serial killer is Robert himself admitted, he's like, I never set out, like, killing was never the end goal for me. My goal was always to create a sex slave that I could just keep captive and torture in my house indefinitely for years or however long I wanted. And it was never his, he never set out to kill anyone. He just wanted to torture them.
Unfortunately, in this case, dying is probably the best thing that happened to these poor men.
Oh, yeah, these poor men. Like, I'm sure death was a sweet release for them after all they suffered. It's horrible that they had to die, but after what they went through.
Could you imagine living for, like, a year and being tortured like this every day? And, I would rather die.
And that's what Robert wanted. He didn't want them to die. He wanted them to suffer. For the next few months, Robert actually took a step back, and he actually began thinking really hard about the best way to balance out his torture methods in order to make his victim live longer, and he even thought long and hard about what it was about the torture that turned him on so much. So again, this is actually a very self-aware serial killer. He is fully aware of what he's doing is messed up, and he's like, why do I enjoy this so much? He eventually concluded that he got off on the idea of being in complete control of another human being, their life, and everything about them, and the way that it was in his control. He loved looking into their eyes when they were being tortured and seeing the complex mix of emotions that conveyed from betrayal to confusion to fear. He loved seeing it happen in front of him. But above all else, he realized that he didn't just want to get off on torturing a captive. He wanted to break someone down to the point where they lost all hope and their sanity would break, causing them to fully give in to his torture and become his permanent sex slave. He began writing down different techniques in his journal about the best way to break his captive's sanity. He knew he wanted to deprive them of their senses, which would include blinding them and deafening them, but he also knew he had to tone down his extreme torture methods if he wanted them to last longer than a few days at a time. But just as Robert was starting to settle into a good routine, an unexpected wrench was thrown into his plan when detectives asked him to come down to the station for questioning. So towards the end of 1985, word had begun spreading amongst the gay hustlers on the streets of Kansas City that Robert Burdella was a man that you should not trust and to be cautious around him. He had developed a reputation by this point for rough sex, with many hustlers later stating that he loved to tie them up and aggressively sodomize them. But despite his reputation, Robert also would pay well and supply the men with drugs, so many continued to go home with him. And although he was, you know, kind of put on a blacklist, it was more of the lines of, if you do accept the offer to go home with him, just keep your guard up and be cautious.
You know what you're getting into.
Just be aware of who you're getting into it with. Now, Jerry Howell's father, Paul, had also been wandering the streets for almost a year at this point, talking with any hustler he could find about if they had any information about his son's disappearance. It had been a year with no word from Jerry, and by this point, both Paul and detectives were starting to believe that this wasn't a simple case of Jerry running away. Many of the hustlers Paul frequently talked to pointed out that Robert was frequently seen hanging out with Jerry and would often offer him drugs to get him into his car. On top of that, several of the hustlers pointed out that Robert Sheldon and Mark Wallace had also not been heard from in some time, and that one of the only known connections between the two men was that they had been seen hanging around Robert's house. Now, at first, Paul initially believed that Robert must have accidentally given Jerry too many drugs, and he overdosed, and Robert hid his body to keep from getting in trouble. He did not fully grasp, like, this was a sadistic killer. He's more like, Robert took advantage of my son, gave him too many drugs, and he overdosed, and he had the body. So Paul took this info to the police, and they were, of course, skeptical of all of it. You know, there was no actual evidence, and everything that was said was nothing more than rumors. And on top of that, investigators knew it wasn't uncommon for gay hustlers to move on to, quote-unquote, more gay-friendly cities without telling anyone. And now that's something we have mentioned a lot with the gay serial killers we have covered, like Herb Baumeister, Larry Eiler. All of them, like the detectives initially, were like, this is the 1980s, 70s, or 90s. So, of course, gay people were migrating to more gay-friendly areas on the East Coast and the West Coast. But I think a lot of investigators used that as an excuse to be like, we don't need to search for them. They were gay in a small city. Of course, they're going to want to run away to a bigger and better life. But even still, just to make sure, they did agree to bring Robert in for questioning with the disappearance of Jerry Howell. So investigators looked over Robert's previous criminal convictions, and they noted his arrest for drug possession and a couple of other minor offenses. But he had no record of any violent crimes or behavior, and that only made them more skeptical he was somehow involved. Robert came in for an interview with his lawyer present, and he answered several questions, telling officers the same story he had before. He dropped Jerry off where he wanted to go, and that was the last time he saw him. The officer doing the interview did note that Robert seemed nervous during it, but just chalked it up to just general nerves about being questioned by police. With absolutely no evidence or even anything suspicious to hold him on, Robert was free to go, and the case was once again chalked up to a case of a runaway, and it was closed. Although he was in the clear, the interview had shaken Robert, and he was nervous about getting caught. However, his desire to try his new torture methods and plans to keep his captive alive for as long as possible was strong enough to overpower his worries. He was ready to put it to the test. The plan he had spent the last several months perfecting was ready for its first true test subject, which we will be telling you about next week in part two of our coverage of Robert Burdella, aka the Kansas City Butcher. So this is going to be a two-parter. It did not set out to be a two-parter, but as I was writing my notes this week, I realized I made it to page 12 of my notes, and we had only covered half of this monster's crimes. So I was like, I don't want to rush it. I want to tell you guys the story as thorough and as detailed as possible without a single episode being like 3.5 hours. So we will be coming back next week to tell you just the absolute horrific atrocities. This man, it gets worse, is the thing. So it is horrific. So we will see you guys next week for that.
Yeah, I mean, 6 of those pages of the 12 was just descriptions of torture, which, man, this is a really rough one to listen to. I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I guess torture is like one of those things, like, you know, I mean, murder is horrible and everything like that, and I think torture takes it to a whole new level that I just absolutely do not like to hear, but I understand also that it is part of the truth of this story and the facts that you have to show just how bad this man was and everything like that. But man.
And that's the thing too, is like, it is the horrible, sad truth to this case is that this man, you know, he may not have as many victims as Gacy or Dahmer or be as well known, but the fact that he tortured his victims so horrifically just, in my opinion, makes him one of the worst serial killers. Because again, he didn't set out to be a serial killer. He just wanted to keep someone captive and just torture them and cause as much pain as possible because he got off on hearing them scream. And so all of his victims were like just consequences. Like they died. Their deaths were consequences of the horrific torture he subjected them to. And it's just so bizarre and fascinating to hear him. Like he is so self-aware of what he's doing. And he's even like, because, you know, a lot of serial killers are like, I can't control it. Like, it's just something that happens. I don't know when it's going to happen. Like, I just get this urge, yada, yada, to kill someone. And then this Robert is like, I'm actually going to take a step back for a few months and reevaluate everything. I'm going to think of why I like this so much in the first place and like reflect on it.
I'm also going to test new things out and see which are my favorite ways to torture someone.
And that too is like, he didn't even have a real victim type. He was like this one guy. He's like, I'm not attracted to them at all. I didn't want to keep them captive per se, but I realized this would be, he would be a good, like, essentially a guinea pig to try out the torture methods I've been wanting to see about. And it's, so it's just so horrible the way he just took months off. He was able to have the self, like, control to take months off from killing someone to be like, I'm really going to sit down and perfect the best torture method to keep them alive for as long as possible, but at the same time, cause them as much pain as possible. And so we'll get into that next week with part two. I told y'all it was going to be a rough one, but it is an important story to tell. And of course, it is important to remember horrible people like this and their victims, because those that forget history are doomed to repeat it. So thank you guys so much for tuning in for another episode. If you like this episode and the podcast in general, please leave us a 5-star review or rating on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out a lot. Helps other people, new people, discover the podcast. And of course, we just love hearing from you guys. Also, still want to work on a like a episode with your telling your guys' creepy and paranormal encounters. We kind of got sidetracked there a few months ago when we were working on it. So if you have a personal creepy or paranormal or just spooky story you want to share with us, you can email it to us at beerswithqueerspodcast@gmail.com. I'll have that link in the show notes. Or just message it to us on our socials on Instagram at beerswithqueerspod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at beerswithqueers, a true crime podcast. You can also find photos from today's case on there. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.